All right, I think we'll get this started. And thanks to all of you who are joining us this evening. And welcome to the August 2025 edition of the DMSC Masterclass. This monthly program connects current DMSC students and faculty and prospective students of the Doctor of Medical Science program at the Arizona School of Health Sciences, A.T. Still University. Our mission is to bring you face to face with inspiring masters in the PA profession, healthcare leaders who have made transformative contributions to our field. And today's guest certainly meets that. A few housekeeping notes before we begin. Please keep your microphones muted during the presentation. As you see, we are recording this. We encourage active participation through the chat feature for comments and questions. And after our discussion with Dr. Cannell, we'll open the floor for live Q&A where you can unmute and engage directly. Dr. Beth Popre, our administrative manager of the DMSC program, will be monitoring the chat and facilitating our discussion. So let's move ahead. I'm really honored to introduce our distinguished guest tonight, Dr. Christopher Cannell. A doctoral trained physician associate whose 22-year clinical journey spans emergency medicine, orthopedics, critical care, and internal medicine. Dr. Cannell has emerged as a nationally recognized authority in healthcare quality, patient safety, and clinical risk management. Beyond his clinical expertise, Christopher serves as a certified medical professional legal consultant and expert witness, bringing deep knowledge in standard of care assessment and clinical risk mitigation. His academic footprint includes adjunct faculty positions at South College, Northeastern University, and Tufts School of Medicine, where he shapes future healthcare professionals in law, policy, and clinical practice. Dr. Cannell's leadership extends through our profession. He currently serves as president of the PAs in Legal Medicine and holds board positions with both the Academy of Doctoral PAs and the Massachusetts Association of PAs. As a sought-after speaker on provider clinical risk management, he actively advances healthcare quality improvement initiatives and interprofessional collaboration. His education foundation includes a Doctor of Medical Science from the University of Lynchburg, completed by specialized training in just culture and high reliability to the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. And there's more to say that we'll do this as we go through the interview. But Christopher, welcome to our master class. We're really thrilled to have you share your insights with us today.
Thanks for having me. Sounds like a great opportunity. I'm very happy to meet you guys.
Excellent. Well, let's just jump right into it, Chris. You know, your journey, as we talked about a minute ago, began at the Massachusetts College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences PA program, where you graduated back in 2003. So let's take us back, to those early days. What initially drew you to the PA profession, and tell us a little bit about some of your clinical work afterwards.
Yeah, I think I was very drawn to medicine very early on in high school. My sister, an event that happens to all of us in our lives triggers our interest in what we may do. So my sister had Hodgkin's lymphoma, and I was very close to my sister when we were young. Thankfully, she pulled right through it. But I just was very just struck by the healthcare bug going to Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York City, which is close to where I grew up in New Jersey. And just always knew I wanted to do something in medicine and wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I was a pre-med track and an undergraduate and wasn't really sure which path I was going to take, and got introduced to the PA profession my senior year college, and sort of applied and never looked back. Got accepted in March of my senior year, and moved to Boston 5 days after I graduated college, and was on my journey there for 3 years in Boston. So I was had a very outstanding education in the Boston area, all the great academic institutions and opportunities, and re really was a second to none education.
Yeah, So, Chris, who was your, do you remember who was your program director at the PA program?
At the time was a gentleman by the name of Carl Fasser, and then George Bottomley followed him after that. So Carl was well known in the Baylor University ranks, and then George, I'm not sure where George went to, but George sort of finished it off when Carl left to go back to Baylor.
Yeah, th those are two names that are well known in the PA profession and some of the folks that I knew decades ago. So I'm glad to hear their names. Tell us a little bit about some of your clinical work right out of PA school.
Yeah, so my wife now of 22 years was in the class ahead of me, and so I was very focused on getting a job right out of PA school, and because we got married about 2 months after I graduated, so I started out in orthopedic surgery, got the first job that was offered to me, first PA ever in that practice, and then third PA ever in my hospital system. Now I'm currently the longest tenured PA in my hospital system. I've seen my role grow dramatically, where they wouldn't accept my orders initially when I was there, to now we've grown to be the largest community employer for all PAs in the state. So it's been quite the journey. And I've raised my family here in the South Shore of Massachusetts, and been sort of in the same healthcare system for the last 22 years, and where I've done all of these roles. In addition to me working at a critical access hospital north of Boston in emergency medicine as well.
Wow. Well, tell us a little bit about what it's like to be married to a PA.
Yeah, I think that's a great question for my kids that hearing it at the dinner table. I think it really helps out. I mean, we talk about wellness right now in the field of medicine, and I really think having her bounce, and she works in the same hospital as me, and she works as a hospitalist, so I think sort of having her really makes it so much easier and so much better for me, and for her, vice versa. So that really helps with overall wellness. So that part of it's great. But I can tell you, my kids don't want to go into medicine when they hear all the stories we tell them. So.
Yeah, I can understand that. Absolutely. None of my kids have decided to go into medicine either. So I get that. Well, Chris, your career trajectory is really remarkable. From clinical practice we just talked about to leadership roles and now serving as president of PAs on Legal Medicine. Walk us through this evolution. What pivotal moments led you to pursue your doctoral level education, and how has that preparation shaped your leadership approach within our profession? Because many of us know that, I mean, you work hard as a clinical PA, but then many of the things that you're doing are volunteer activities. Why are you doing that?
Yeah, I've been characterized as restless many times in my life, and I think that restlessness is what sort of drives me. I mean, I'm a perpetual endurance athlete, marathoner. Just sounds like this group is exercising right now, so that part I love it. So that's just my nature of who I am. I've always been that way. I've always been wired that way, and again, a wife is a PA, and sort of going through everything I went through as a PA in my healthcare system, and I was always raised that I can achieve anything if I put my mind to it, and I've always been very struck by the passion to represent PAs and have PAs that we can do whatever we want and what we're driven to, and I don't think the PA profession is some sort of limiting factor, so. That's my motivation. I want to drive PAs to the forefront of healthcare. We are everywhere. We are the fabric of every single healthcare system. We are what make clinical care run, and I believe that we're destined for more. And I think that's where the doctorate degrees come into play here. So I'm really focused on advocacy, which is a lot of the work I did with MAPPA. I just finished up my 2 year commitment with MAPPA, and really focused on my work with APOM and ADPA right now, and really want to bring the doctorate degree to the forefront. Really bring our skills to the forefront and show that we're capable of being anywhere in medicine, in every area that has traditionally been a physician or nurse. And so I've been involved as a leadership chair at my healthcare system, really trying to change the verbiage and job descriptions to always include PAs in it. So that's always been my goal, is to drive our profession to the forefront.
Yeah, and thank you for doing that. And you sort of brought this up, completing your DMSC and now serving on the Academy of Doctoral PAs Board of Directors, you really have a unique perspective on doctoral preparation. And so, since most of the folks who are attending here today and throughout our program are seeking their DMS, how do you see doctoral education transforming our profession, if you do? And more importantly, what specific advice would you give current DMSC students to maximize their doctoral experience and prepare for leadership roles?
Yeah, I just got interviewed by Medscape on this a couple of weeks ago, representing ADPA, and I really think there's a lot of value to the doctorate degree. I mean, I think you look and see what other professions are doing. Pharmacists are trying to get increased ability to take care of patients, and we put out a big letter against opposing the AMA, and I feel very strongly that in order for us to solve the problems in medicine, we all have to work together and respect one another, and we all have to work at the top of our licenses. And I for one believe that I applaud the pharmacists for doing what they're doing. I applaud, every profession trying to work at the top of the license, and we should be no different. This is where I think the doctorate degree comes into play, because I think this gives us a seat at the table. And I feel eventually that we're no longer going to be asking for a seat at the table. We're going to be hopefully owning the table. We're going to be in charge of the table, and we don't have to ask any longer. So I think that doctorate degree affords that. I think the education that we're receiving within our doctorate degree, and I felt like my education at Lynchburg was phenomenal. I felt like the certificate programs are a great decision. I think that's going to draw. We actually talked about this amongst us at the board our board meeting last night, ADPA, about these certificate programs. So I think the more that we can educate ourselves on the sort of economics of healthcare and the leadership within healthcare, it's just going to put us ahead of the curve for others. So this is I really think that's what the doctorate degree affords.
Yeah, and wow, what a great bumper sticker. Don't be at the table, own the table. I like that. So, Chris, you're nationally recognized for healthcare quality and patient safety expertise as well. Can you share a concrete example of a quality improvement initiative that you've championed, whether in clinical practice or leadership roles? And what were the measurable outcomes, and what lessons can others apply from your experience?
Yeah, I think some of the best work that I've done within my healthcare system is really being one of the chief thought leaders representing the PAs and MPs in my healthcare institution, both on the outpatient sector and inpatient sector, just working on sort of door to provider times within the ER. And I've been involved in multiple triage implementation processes, and just there's tons of committee work within the hospital system on the P&T committee and the microbial committee. I've raised my hand and said, why are PAs on these committees? Why are we not involved? And so I've tried to lead from the front and raise my hand and try to be involved in all these where PAs weren't involved before, because we're the ones delivering the care. We need to be one of the thought leaders and decision makers. So, I was one of the key cogs within multiple triage implementations. I currently work in the busiest ER in the state of Massachusetts. We're busier than Mass General Hospital. We're busier than Brigham Women's Hospital, and we have the lowest inpatient volume. So we have to be very dynamic in how we approach patient care for patient safety wise, because we're pretty, we have a lot of academic affiliations in the care that we provide. We have to really be thoughtful in how we approach patient care. So I would say it's just me raising my hand and being involved in all of these different committees and setting the tone for my colleagues behind me, so that they understand that we are allowed to have a seat at the table, and that now we're one of the few hospitals that have seats on the executive board within the hospital system. We're now voting members now. We're on different types of councils that we know we weren't on before. So again, we're pulling our seat up to the table now. We're participating. We're getting there.
Well, that's wonderful. And Chris, I met you actually, you may remember, a couple of years ago at the AAPA when I was giving a short lecture, and we had a great conversation, about legal medicine. And it, with over 8 years as a medical professional legal consultant, I'm sure you've seen the full spectrum of clinical risk scenarios. You and I have talked about that, you know. So what patterns do you observe in the most common risk factors facing PAs today, you know, and how can practicing PAs proactively protect themselves and their patients while maintaining, you know, good care standards? Now, I realize this is a whole hour conversation, but, you know, in a short period of time, you know, what should we let our colleagues know what the risk factors are and how they should try to avoid those?
So there's a lot of recurring themes in the work that I do and what I see. One of those themes that really is concerning for me, which I'd like to see a better, and I didn't have this when I transitioned from orthopedic surgery in the beginning of my career very quickly to emergency medicine. I don't th I We need to have a better infrastructure in place for training and teaching and mentoring and having that infrastructure in place, because that didn't exist when I was a PA, and I could tell you that physicians were very standoff. They didn't really know how to interact with PAs. So I think one of the chief ways to prevent a lot of this, because I do see a lot of these problems that exist in like urgent care environments or environments where that there's not that sort of infrastructure in place for the big in the early career PAs to bounce stuff off of from a supervising collaborating perspective, is setting up that infrastructure for training so that you're not set up for failure. I would say that, someone asked me like, why do you have such passion for the field of legal medicine? It's because, I got sued, early on in my career. And thankfully I won, but it taught me a valuable lesson from like an infrastructure standpoint. There needs to be a very robust system so that we're not set up to fail, because there's a lot of that work with from a vicarious liability standpoint, or getting the physician involved when they weren't involved. So I think we just created infrastructure for training and education for early career PAs, transitional career PAs, to make sure that they're going to be safe and that they feel supported. So that's number one. And I think I see a lot of that commonly in like urgent care environments. And they're so focused on the economics of patient flow. So I think I would love to see improvements in that. And I see a lot of other problems when it comes to documentation and transitions in care and that communication that exists. So I would really emphasize the use of slowing down, making sure that you are advocating to your leadership in your facility or wherever you're at, so that you can be thoughtful and provide the appropriate documentation that you need necessary so that you can protect yourself. And then that transitions in care. So if you're in like the inpatient side, if you're, signing people out from like a critical care, emergency medicine, inpatient care perspective, if you're doing general surgery, neurosurgery, whatever it may be, those are the highest risk times. When people may not have as much knowledge or invested in it. So making sure that you have robust systems in place for that transitions in care to occur. And I think I had this conversation most recently at our department meeting, that one of the easiest thing you can do is as a, to prevent any malpractice case, it's just be kind. Be kind to everyone around you. I don't care if it's the cleaning person, the physician you're working with, the pharmacist, the patient. Be kind, be patient. I had a patient tell me today, "You're one of the first people that has ever listened to me, truly listened to me." And I pride myself on doing that with patients, where you spend time, just let them talk, give them the ability to talk without cutting them off, and just spend that time. So I think if you could be kind and document in a professional manner, I think those are the key areas I would t tell people to focus on. Because you may you someone may make a mistake, but if you are kind, approachable, to that patient, they're less apt to sue you, and the data supports that.
Yeah, well said. You know, Chris, you're really passionate about it, advancing the quadruple aim through interprofessional collaboration. Could you describe a specific interprofessional project that you've led or been instrumental in? How did it simultaneously improve patient experience or population health or cost effectiveness and provider satisfaction? And really, what made that successful?
Yeah, so I would say one of the projects I've been involved with is sort of like a population health initiative. So because so my team in my department saw that I was very passionate about sort of addressing flow issues within our ER, and then addressing quality of care issues, improving wellness, et cetera. And so we focus on five or six of the major players for the urgent cares within the immediate area. And we focus on mechanisms to determine, was this an avoidable ER visit or was it not an avoidable ER visit? And then we focused on, better cost initiatives that what systems could we create, such as like an outpatient duplex ultrasound or outpatient CT imaging or outpatient labs or some sort of infrastructure for communication that they can directly communicate with the specialist as opposed to just send them to the ER as the easiest solution. So I was involved in that type of project and presented my findings to the C-suite, and we then initiated conversations and dialogues with those facilities, and then implemented programs that within my facility to make it easier for them to get access to care, where, rather than just sending them to the ER. So that improved flow and throughput through the system.
Wow, that's great. It's really about showing up, isn't it? Being there and showing up. So yeah, thank you for that. We talked about this during the introduction that as adjunct faculty at the three prestigious institutions, you're shaping the next generation of PAs, particularly in healthcare law and policy. When you talk to entry-level students, what concepts do you emphasize with students as they get ready to go out to practice, and how do you prepare them for the rapidly evolving healthcare landscape where policy and practice sort of intersect daily?
Yeah, my response to them is that they've made a commitment to take care of patients. They made a commitment to healthcare, and healthcare is evolving. I tell people to be humble, and be ready to learn. Be ready to listen to what your colleagues are saying. Seek out information as much as possible. Read JAPA. Read whatever way you access healthcare information via email. Open evidence. I use open evidence a ton in my clinical practice. I've been involved in an AI project, and I really believe in AI and how we can use AI to assist us. So I think my key themes are is just raise your hand, be an advocate, because we there's not enough people who are advocating for PAs out there. And I fell victim to that early on in my career. I was so busy being a full-time clinician, taking care of my kids because my wife was also working, so we would flip-flop with our schedules. But at one point, I just Randy, you talked about sort of when did I sort of have that awakening? I would say that my awakening occurred right before the pandemic, and I just said, I'm tired of it. I need to get more involved, and I saw an avenue for that, and I felt like that avenue was, raising my hand more, and going for my DMSC and getting more engaged and involved, rather than some of the other work that I was doing before that. And so I could tell you that it has been so rewarding. And I have met some very, very talented PAs out there who are advocating for the profession. And I hope to continue to work with those PAs. I'm going to the advocacy and leadership summit next month. And I'm really looking forward to meeting with everyone and continuing these efforts.
Excellent. Well, you sort of brought this up. Let's jump to this issue. Your expertise as a subject matter expert in generative AI development positions you at the forefront of healthcare's technological transformation. A day doesn't go by that I don't get an email about what AI is doing in healthcare and in every other, part of society. How do you envision artificial intelligence reshaping PA practice, and what should current doctoral students understand about integrating these technologies into their future roles?
Yeah, I think it's I think we talk about AI as like augmenting our ability to provide care. I mean, I like it because it's, to me, and I found like I'm using open evidence, for example, way more than I'm using up to date anymore, because I'm finding that, hey, I can get access to this information so much faster and it's reliable. And this, so I find it's very helpful. I think ambient AI gives us more back to the bedside for the patient, and it gives us more efficiency in the job that we're doing. So I think those two areas are going to be, very efficient. I think I think when it comes to coding, I think when it comes to having taking back some of the money that we need for healthcare systems that are really struggling financially and strapped, I think AI is going to assist us in that when it comes to like, meeting criteria for CMS, door to provider times, sepsis criteria, all these types of things that we need to do better in from a coding and documentation standpoint. And I think, if we can sort of save some money on the administrative end from a billing standpoint, from a prior authorization standpoint, we can implement AI in those areas as well. And I think if we can provide better patient care, because we're never going to re replace clinicians, but if we can use it to augment the care that we're providing, I'm all for it.
Great, well said. Well, let's take a minute and delve into some current PA professional issues. Believe it or not, it been 8 years ago, back in 2017, when the AAPA House delegates approved what was called Optimal Team Practice Model, which marked a significant shift in how we conceptualize PA practice. And what's your assessment of this initiative 8 years out? Do you believe it adequately addresses the scope of practice challenging PAs today, in the healthcare environment?
Yeah, I think we've moved to this terminology now, PA modernization, which I think I really love that terminology better, because I do, and this is one of the reasons why I'm so excited for the work I'm doing with APOM, because some you know I we when I came onto the board at APOM, I really wanted to change some of our mission about what we're doing with APOM, and I really wanted to focus on this very issue, which was this modern optimal team practice PA modernization, because we have these compact agreements that are going into place, and I really think with what's going on with the evolution of the PA profession, we're going to be in the public's eye a lot more now and scrutinized for the work that we're doing. Not that we're not already, but I think in order to support that, I really would love to see us teaching the best practices, which includes sort of the people that do the review work, in APOM. We're reviewing cases all the time, and so I would love for us to be entrenched in these PA programs across the country so that we can have a very structured system in place that we're teaching the same types of education to every PA out there, so that when we go in the practice, we can be more successful. And so with these PA modernization laws, I think, when we talk about how we're going to approach this, I love what some of these states are doing, like Utah, Montana, Arizona, like looking at the number of clinical hours that we're doing. I think that sort of when you look at that and you compare that with the medical school education and the education hours and residency, I think that really aligns with professional competency. So I would really like us to sort of focus on the best care that we can deliver, and that's based upon the data from medical legal, such as like the Candelo, which is a representation of over one third of all the malpractice cases out there, which shows time and time again which are the similar things that come up. So if we can address those things in PA schools and really have PA students hit the ground running when they go out in the practice, I think that would be ideal.
Yeah, I think you're right on target, and I really like the way you sort of couch that in a modernization rather than optimal OTP. I think sometimes our other folks think that we're really focusing on independence, when what I think we're focusing on is an enhanced team practice. And so I think that's your point. So thank you for that. Well, let's go to the other issue, the I won't say the recent title change, because it's been a number of years now, from physician assistant to physician associate, approved by the House of Delegates and then ratified by the AAPA. It's certainly sparked considerable discussion outside the profession and somewhat inside the profession, but we're now seeing that a number of states have changed their state association title to physician associate, like Oregon. And a number of specialty organizations have changed it. And even some schools have now changed their degree to physician associate. So what's your perspective on this historic change? How do you see it impacting our identity and public understanding of our role?
I love it. I think it's a better definition of who we are and what we're doing. I never embraced the assistant title, to be honest with you. I never felt at all like an assistant. And I think I would advocate strongly that we are really strong players in the healthcare system, and then I'm really excited to do away with the assistant title. So I think it's it's just like anything. There's a progression in healthcare happening, and the same has happened with our training. I mean, we're just a couple credits short of a doctorate degree anyway with our training. So, I just think when we compare ourselves maybe to some other providers, and I certainly don't like the term mid-level. It's a terrible term. So I'm very much a strong advocate for the associate title, because I really it's a, just more, a better representation of who we are. And just like you said, we're not looking to be a clinician who is not part of the team. I think that's what we're advocating for. We're advocating for to be part of the team, to be collaborating members of the team, and that team is a team full of all different types of personnel. There's pharmacists, physicians, nurse practitioners, nurse midwives, nurses, medical assistants. And I think that we'd like to be part of the team and have a title that more reflects of what our training is and what we're capable of.
Yeah, well said. And the next topic really is there's been an ongoing debate, certainly for the last 5 years, about the entry-level doctorate degree in PA education. I know PAEA has taken a stand, a definitive stand over the last few years, to maintain the master's level as the entry level, although they have a task force looking at a potential change, as does the AAPA. So, given your extensive experience in both clinical practice and education, what are your thoughts on this potential evolution in PA training requirements, and what implications do you foresee for the profession with this?
Yeah, in the current state, I believe that as I've sort of have said this multiple times to people, and this may or may not be a controversial answer, but I don't, in its current state, I don't believe that the doctorate degree is a clinical degree. I believe it's more of a leadership degree, education degree. It gives us a seat at the table because of the doctorate title. Again, we're sort of earning this already anyway. We're just a few credits short of a doctorate degree anyway. I mean, I went to Mass College of Pharmacy. I was there for 3 years. And I was I went to school longer than my best friend at the time, who was a pharmacist, and he went to school for 6 years and got a doctorate degree. So, I think it needs to align with the credit hours, right? And I strongly believe that in its current state, the doctorate training is an advanced degree for us to have a seat at the table as a professor. As a in industry, for in the pharmaceutical industry, the biotech industry, when it comes to healthcare administration, because it's really a tremendous training that not even doctors are getting at all in their training from a healthcare leadership standpoint. I mean, I thought it was a tremendous training in that perspective. But I think as we sort of go with this PA modernization and we make it as an entry-level doctorate degree, I think, and as we start looking at, what is it going to be our practice environment, I think it does align. I mean, we start looking at, we're beholden to sort of what the profession is. What defines us is our ability to practice in different types of professions. So you want to move to, ER, to interventional radiology or psychiatry. I think we need to embrace that, because no other profession really does that as well as what we do. But I do like the fact that you have that entry level doctorate degree, and then you hit a certain amount of hours, and then you're basically considered in an independent practice. I think that's the future. I think that's where we can start contributing to patient access and patient care.
Yeah, well said. Well, let me throw another question and Chris, this is one I didn't send to you in advance, so you don't have to answer it if you don't want to. But over the last, 6 months, there's been some significant controversy in the post-professional doctorate arena. As you know, the consortium of DMSC slash DPA programs, has published a resolution opposing the ARC-PA of providing accreditation standards for post-professional programs. And as the PAEA also has opposed that, and I believe ADPA has come out with some
Yes.
discussions about that as well. And not to get too controversial, and obviously I'm biased in terms of what that is and have a lot to say about it, but I'd like to hear what your thoughts are on this issue of RPA trying to jump in the post-professional doctorate accreditation arena.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, I feel like we all need to have a seat at the table to discuss this. I think there are a lot of people that are in this arena, and I think it's important that we don't have one dominating voice in it. And I think that that now I think we're up to 38 doctorate programs now, and so the programs have been doing some great work, and so they have a lot to say about this topic. And I don't know that the RPA should be sort of stepping in and trying to be the dominating force. I just don't think that's appropriate. I do think that there should be a collaborative spirit in this. I know there's been some controversy in the past between NCCPA and AAPA, et cetera, but I'm sort of like a fun-loving '60s guy. Like, I think we can all get along. And I think when we have exceptional voices and exceptional talent in the room, let's all have a voice and let's all talk, and we're all in it for the same reason. We at least we should be, is to advocate for the profession and move the profession forward. So I think we need to push past some of those, some of those issues and really focus on what's important here. So my
Yeah.
response is, let us all have a seat at the table and collaborate.
Good deal. And by the way, if you're a 60s guy, you had to be pretty young, I might say. So.
Well, I wasn't born in the '60s, I will say, but
There
I love the '60s music, so.
you go. I'm with you. Well, so we're heading into the home stretch here, but Chris, as you look ahead, what do you see as the most significant opportunities and challenges facing our profession? And you sort of talked about this earlier, but again, how can our doctorally prepared PAs position themselves to be effective leaders in addressing whatever the critical issue is?
Yeah, I think there's a great opportunity now where I think people are starting to develop that confidence, and that spirit that you can raise your hand now and get more involved. And I would like to see PAs be more pervasive across all areas, healthcare policy, government work. We have how many PAs have we had in the White House? I mean, that's just phenomenal. You're seeing PAs and involved in Netflix, in charge of occupational health for some of these major, companies. So I would like us to see and have greater notoriety in all areas. Once upon a time, PAs felt like they can only do two things: work as a clinician or work in academia. And I just don't feel like that's the case anymore. I think you're seeing PAs in industry all over the place now. I think you're seeing, PAs involved as entrepreneurs, which is an area that I'm very, very invested in. Because I think if we're going to solve some of these major problems in healthcare, we need to be thought-provoking. We need to be innovative in our thoughts. And I think we need to, I think the doctorate program, in my opinion, is that education, and that springboard towards being entrepreneurs, to looking at the opportunities in behavioral health, to looking at opportunities to train and teach others in telemedicine and dermatology in areas that, where patients need access to brick and mortar primary care practices, concierge practices. Find those niches that are out there that are necessary for patients to seek care. I mean, I would love for us to sort of be entrepreneurs, and own our own practices. I think that's the wave of the future for PAs. When I spoke at the Denver AAPA, when I was one of the speakers for the PAs for the entrepreneurship lectures, it was life changing for me, to see the energy in the room, the excitement in the room. I just in my 22 years as a PA, I just haven't seen that. I have not seen the excitement that PAs have now to be their own entrepreneurs, to potentially own their own practices, to be successful. And I think PAs are slowly but surely getting that attitude now. We're like, hey, I can do this. I can be successful at it. So that's where I see that profession going.
Yeah, well said. So Before we open it up for questions, I'd like to ask something more personal. With your incredibly demanding schedule, spanning both clinical work and education and consulting and leadership roles, what do you do for fun and personal fulfillment? And how do you maintain that so important balance, life balance, and prevent burnout?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question because I have this. So I decided that in order for me to seek greater professional and personal fulfillment, I needed to cast a wide net so that I can then narrow my focus so that I can sort of find that niche that's going to allow me to create have that greater sense of fulfillment. So my fulfillment to me is my kids. It's being there for my kids. So I work 312s currently as a clinician. So I work full time as a clinician. My adjunct roles with Northeastern and Tufts are precepting and training students in emergency medicine, orthopedic surgery, mostly emergency medicine. And then my other work with South College, and I just signed on with Marshall C. Ketchum University too for their doctorate program for the healthcare policy and advocacy. So that I see my casting that wide net to narrow my focus so that I have more time in the future. So my fun to me is watching my kids in sports, just being there for them. So I coached my daughter for lacrosse for 7 years. I'm a big sports junkie, but I'm a big endurance athlete. So I my where I gain the most wisdom as a father, as a person, are on my runs with my friends. So I do a lot of long runs and running with my friends, and I've done a lot of marathoning and but to me it's all about the competition doing that, and I try to be pretty competitive with my running. So I enjoy exercise.
Well, that's great. And earlier we talked a little bit about your wife. Tell us a little bit about your kids.
Yeah, so I have a 20-year-old who's going to be a third year at Rochester Institute of Technology. So it's funny story is he's working as a AI engineer this summer, doing some of that work with me with a medical legal consulting. So he's helping me help utilizing AI in some of my medical legal work. So he enjoys that. And then I have a sophomore in high school who goes to Boston College High School in Boston, and then I have a daughter who's going into her freshman year at another Catholic school here in Massachusetts.
Wow, that's great. Okay, well, I'd like to go ahead. Anything else?
Oh yeah, and just yeah, my wife is we're plugging away and raising the kids, so
Yeah,
she's
yes.
high energy too.
Wow, and you need that. Thank goodness. Well, so I'd like to open our discussion, for questions from our participants here. So feel free to unmute yourself and share your questions with Dr. Cannell. We certainly have time for a number of questions, so don't hesitate to engage. And Dr. Popper, I don't know if there's anything on the chat. If you could check that for us as well.
We do have one in the chat. Let me see. From Erica. Great encouraging talk. Thank you. I love hearing the perspective I have had on needing more collaborative work between PAs and, excuse me, and between APPs. I am working on an initiative to start up an anal dysplasia clinic in Central Ohio. We have a very large LGBT community and a great need to raise both awareness and access for these patients to get the specialty care they need. What would you recommend as insight, guidance, et cetera, to get buy-in from my hospital system, as the initial startup will not be much of a moneymaker for the system, but ultimately be a financial as well as community and health benefit to our area?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is exactly where PAs are going to excel in. I think we're looking at niches where we need to help patients and provide access to care. And so I think just raising your hand and taking the lead on it and saying like this is an area that we need to address. With the doctorate level education and training, you have the ability to lead and be and develop such a great clinic. So my hope is that you raise your hand and that and if people turn you down, you don't back down. You keep on pushing forward, because there's a need out there. And I think sort of networking with like-minded people to sort of say if you hit any roadblocks, just don't stop. just keep on networking, finding those people who share a similar passion that you may have, and just finding, ways that you can make it work. I've been told many, many times in my career, and I don't accept no for an answer. I think that we're capable of anything. You just have to put the work into it and prove it to people.
Thank you. Other folks who might have questions, please unmute yourself and ask. Kendra.
I have a question. First of all, I just want to say how impressive your life has been. I consider you was you you say you weren't born in the 60s, so I consider you to be young. And I would say you have such an incredible history. You have a history of somebody who's been doing this, like Barbara Danielson, doing this. You have so many branches on your tree. And so I just applaud you for that because it just seems that you are living the PA mantra to the fullest and doing so many things that are so diverse. And I think that's very impressive. And I have one more thing to say, then I have my question. I
Thank
think
you.
another great thing is you have still been 22 years. Did you say 22 years you've been practicing? That's a long time. And so I also applaud you for still having that vigor and that passion and that fire. We all see that in the new graduates. I was there, and I've had that challenge over the years, kind of keeping that vigor. But you have it, and not only that, you're giving so much of your extra time, minimal time with an active family. You're coaching your daughter's team. It's just amazing how you find time to do that as an active advocate. So I just want to say thank you, really,
Yeah,
for.
I think my biggest motivation is my kids, to be honest with you. I really take it very seriously that I've always said to my, I've always felt like I've been meant to do something special. My parents always, told that to all of their kids, and I take it very seriously that I want to set an example for my kids. And I find that very important. So I try to teach the same concepts to them. My wife and I feel very strongly about these same concepts that you can do anything you put your mind to. And I think just being restless, I think, is important. But like I want to see our profession, not only survive but evolve and prosper. And I've just seen so much of us for far too long be held down. I think we perpetually have these ceilings that are being placed on us, and I just think that we can break through these ceilings and prosper. And I was tired of sitting on the sidelines, feeling trapped, feeling that we just can't do it. And I just said, you know what, I need to lead by going in the forefront of this and sort of preaching to others that we need to do this together. So
Right. You
that's
had
my
every
motivation.
excuse not to, and that's what's so commendable. You had every excuse not to. But here's my question. So where do you see yourself in 5 years? I know that we already have this question similar to Dr. Jamison, but do you have these other type because you have these great initiatives right now. Anything else that you think I just have to do like on my PA bucket list?
Yeah, and on my PA bucket list, to me is I think careers are all about steps, and I don't necessarily think that we all have to go in the same direction. Like I felt very strongly, we don't have to be clinicians the rest of our lives, and I've sort of have said this to my students. So I feel very passionate that as I move in towards this, second phase of my career, is that I really want to focus on healthcare quality and safety and risk mitigation, very specifically with PAs and healthcare advocacy. And I've like where my focus is, I really want to proceed with is where I've actually we signed on to a partnership. You guys are gonna laugh about my continual energy here, but I've signed on where we have a partnership that we're gonna be putting together a healthcare disruptors conference. And so I really see like this moving into the next phase of my career where we create a space where healthcare providers can be innovative, and sort of have their own businesses and be successful in their own businesses. Because I do think we talked about sort of owning the table, Randy. Like when PAs are owning their own businesses, when PAs are leading in the front, and these titles are no longer just specific to nurses or physicians out there, that's where I think the success is going to be. So I would like to move my career more towards that, leading by creating an environment where people can learn to be successful and learn and network with one another. And so that's that part of it. And then I would really like to do more on the healthcare law landscape. Because I think the best environment, don't tell the attorneys I work with who pay my consulting fees, but I think the best system out there is we can eventually, decrease all of these lawsuits. And I think from a wellness perspective for PAs and physicians and whoever is involved, if we can move towards greater quality and use AI for that and use great and create better systems, I just see so much pervasive burnout out there. And my colleagues, I was just working today, and people are just so burnt out, and it's just because of volume, and we're always pressured to see so much volume,
I would like
and
to. Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt. Oh,
I just
continue. No, please
I would
continue.
love to solve that.
Well, I just wanted to. My wheels were turning at the very end of that last sentence because I just thought to myself about. I mean, I thought your energy. It's infectious. And I was going to invite you to consider. I serve on the medical team for the Ironman, the World Championships in Kona, and just hearing you how you're an avid runner, and I thought, gosh. If ever you have a little extra time, if that's something that interests you, because we have a lot of emergency medicine, if you can imagine, but it's something that really aligns with my lifestyle. And so I was thinking, oh my gosh, you would really, I think, enjoy that. So if you're interested down the road, let me know and
Yeah,
we can talk
that's
about that. So.
when life slows down. My friends, I'm going to start moving more into doing ultra marathons. I've done one, but I would love to. Yeah, I've been to Kona. I love it. It's one of my
It's
favorite. That's where we.
such a fun week.
Yeah. I would love to do that. It sounds great.
Thank you.
All right, great. Other folks might have comments or questions. Just unmute.
We do have a question in the chat from Charlie. Hello, I own my own PA clinic from 2007 until 2023 in Las Vegas. I would like to join you when you start your business for a PA initiative.
Yeah, it sounds great. Please connect with me and contact. We're in the process of getting the conference up and running, but to me, like th this is where we're this is where like th this is where innovation is going to happen. This is where people are going to rub elbows with one another, get taught, best practices, how they were successful in opening up their own telemedicine business. And the best way to do that is learn from people who have done it before, who have been successful in those areas, and just trials and tribulations of that, and then you work with people who are because I think a lot of what I hear so much is people struggle with like the funding component of it, and physicians and dentists are getting this preferential funding. Why? Why do they get it and PAs don't? We're a better investment, in my opinion. So, my hope is that we get this conference together, and I don't want it to just be PAs. I want it to be I want it to be all other healthcare professionals, because again, I don't believe in this AMA bull crap of silos. I believe in collaboration, because that's the only way we're going to solve healthcare access is through collaboration, is by everybody practicing at the top of their license, and working with one another. So, love it. Send me a message. We would love to have you.
Excellent. Yeah, Jim.
Well, Chris, thanks very much. I appreciate all the perspectives you gave. And one of my passions too is I've really said that I think states are missing the boat when they're not putting PAs out in rural areas and that sort of thing. But I teach professional practice as well. Healthcare policy and advocacy is going to be added. But one of the things that you have to realize, and I really appreciate everybody's passions, but there's so many regulations within the states that are barriers. And I still think that before we can actually talk about PAs being owners, and I don't know about the regulations in Nevada, but the majority of states in the nation don't allow a PA to own a practice.
Right.
They've linked a lot of that inability to own a practice is because we've been linked to a relationship with a physician. Now, CMS removed that barrier in 2022. And that's one of the, and going back looking into, and I'm going to weave in the OTP concept as well, because we have to look at, what the nurse practitioners did and from the Balanced Budget Act, when they didn't get physician supervision wasn't required, they are now independent in what, 27 or 28 states. So maybe we need to change that OTP to sort of have that vision of being more independent, to be more. I fully believe, like everybody else does, that we do work collaboratively in healthcare, but independent in the sense that we can own a practice, we are independent from a relationship with a physician, and that we can bill independently. And we have that ability now. So I think it's time that we really focus on regulations where we remove those barriers. And that's going to be the roadblock at this point. So I think we need to get together to get those barriers done.
Yeah, totally agree. And I think part of the solution is to that is we need to make sure that we have representation on every single state board. And I don't see a reason why does a physician need, or any other profession need to be on the state boards? So that should be completely run by PAs. And that's one of my biggest areas I want to see improvement with APOM is champion that effort as well, is that we start sort of leading with that, and that with that in mind, then we can work better with all the different types of medical societies in the states. But you're right, there are barriers and roadblocks everywhere. But we just need to keep it up. We can't stop. If we're going to have our profession survive, I mean, we're struggling in different states where nurse practitioners are outnumbering us significantly, because of some of these regulatory barriers. So, but we need numbers. We need numbers of PAs to get involved in advocacy. Just not enough PAs out there who are involved and engaged. And so, if we're going to survive, we got to recruit.
Well, it's interesting on that, to piggyback that, and those who haven't maybe haven't seen it, but there was an article today in Health Affairs where, and I can't quote the exact the study, but there's a study done of PAs working in ERs in rural communities.
Yeah, I saw
And
that.
many rural communities don't have physicians. And so in many rural hospitals, their bread and butter for manning ERs is PAs. And it was a very good article because it really is putting the kibosh on organized medicine, talking about how non-physician providers aren't competent to be able to do these things. Yet many rural communities are only surviving by using PAs and nurse practitioners to provide healthcare in those areas. So hopefully it's getting more in the literature. And I think that's one of the things that's also missing. You went through the doctor program, I've gone through the doctor program, and it was always hard. Every time we would do a literature search, it would be difficult to get papers on PAs. We could get lots on everybody else, but there wasn't much that did research on our profession. And I hopefully what I like to see that the doctorate program is doing is creating researchers who can publish information about what our profession is doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a huge part of what the doctorate degree training is we're beholden to this type of work. I know I published my first paper, my first article with University of Lynchburg, and I really thought it was a very fun process to do that. But and this is what we're really focusing on with ADPA is that sort of authoring papers side of it, because then that notoriety is going to get recognized. So I totally agree.
Excellent. Anybody else? Oh, somebody's talking. Oh, there you go. Go
There I
ahead.
am. So I'm Charlie. So I just want to make a comment because I have gotten my practice pretty much approved with everyone very early in the game. And one of the things that's true out there is that in America, anybody can own a business. So this is how I got the practice. So I could actually own a bakery without being a baker. So I had gotten permission from Medicare. I went straight to Medicare and they told me I could own the practice as long as I didn't own 5% of it, which I gave to my son at the time, who was only 8 years old. They don't let you do that now. But after doing that, then I had to structure the practice so that I was not the boss over the supervising physician. The supervising physician was an independent contractor, and we had to behave with that relationship. And we were able to do that for many years. So I think that when we go after this, we don't really need to go after the fact that we're not letting a PA own a practice. We have to go after the fact that anybody can own a business. Anybody can have a tax ID. And then once you have the tax ID, then you have to behave the way the structure is when it comes to PAs and physicians. That relationship has to exist. And now in LA, I live in a rural community outside of Nevada, and you're absolutely right. There are PAs and MPs. We run practices out here, and that's because nobody really wants to live in a rural community. A lot of physicians don't want to come out to rural communities. They have families and like the city life better.
What are you practicing?
So this is really funny. I have another project going on. I started a new business, an online business, but I practice in family practice and I get internal medicine. And I've been off for 2 months. It's been wonderful. So this is my first time being off since high school. So I love it.
Good for you. Well,
Thank
thank you for
you.
putting your neck out there and doing what you did. That was innovative, and hopefully people continue to do that.
Yeah, I'd love to work with you on that.
Yeah, please reach out.
Okay.
Chris, we've had a couple of people ask us in the chat if they could get your contact information, if that's okay with you.
Yeah.
Which email would you like us to give to them?
Yeah, just shoot me an email at my consulting work, which is chris@theapcconsultant.com. And that's my business. That's my LLC. That'd be great.
Great. Great. All right. Anybody else before we sort of end this thing? I don't see anybody. Chris, before I end it, any last words from you?
Yeah, thank you. I think this is a great audience, and you guys are truly inspiring. I love all the doctorate programs out there, and I think we're doing great work. And keep up the fight. I hope to continue to call you guys colleagues and learn from you guys. And I think we have to continue to work with one another. I think we're all on the same mission.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. And I want to express our heartfelt gratitude to Dr. Cannell for sharing his valuable time and expertise and insights with us today. You know, his remarkable journey serves as both an inspiration and a roadmap for all of us in the PA profession. And he exemplifies the incredible impact we can achieve when we commit to excellence, service, and lifelong learning. So for the rest of you, thank you for joining us and making this such an engaging and enriching session. Your thoughtful questions and active participation elevated the entire experience. Mark your calendars for our next DMSC masterclass on September 22nd. We will have Jim Ally. Jim is a graduate of AT Stell University entry-level program and the Doctor of Medical Science program. But also important is here's a guy who put together a healthcare system in South Phoenix, which is an inner city area, and over a number of years put together a very successful number of practices that he eventually sold and is now working with the Academy of PAs in Family Medicine. And it will share with us his successes and how his ownership of a clinic was very successful. So put that on your calendar. We'll send more detailed information later. So until then, I wish you all continued success in your studies and professional endeavors. Keep pushing those boundaries of what's possible in healthcare. And thank you and have a wonderful rest of your evening.
Thanks for the opportunity, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris.
All right, have a good one.